Now that we know that this is the land of Israel, now the question is, can you give it away? So this also is dependent on two details. The first detail, who is giving it away? What's the status of the state of Israel? Is the state of Israel akin to royalty, a melech, because it's a Jewish government? Or is it just one more secular government? If in fact it's akin to royalty, and there's, by the way, a fascinating discussion in Maimonides that suggests that something happens that one day, when the majority of the Jewish people, and the two opinions, one is the majority of the overall Jewish people, the other is that it's simply the largest Jewish community in the world. When the largest Jewish community lives in Israel, and or the majority of the Jewish world, and they have a government that is Jews, that government will have a din for certain things, a ruling of malchut, of royalty. That government will have halachic implications, Jewish traditional implications. Now, Maimonides was writing this. There were maybe 3,000 Jews living in the land of Israel. This was so hypothetical as to be absurd. Today, our generation is seeing there are big demographic debates about whether this has already happened or is going to happen, depending on how much of the Russian Aliyah is actually Jewish. We are witnessing for the first time that the largest Jewish community in the world, I think it's personally already happened, is now living in the land of Israel. Which means, by the way, that the government of the state of Israel may have halachic implications, halachic authority. And certainly the chief rabbinate, I don't know if you know anything about the chief rabbinate in Israel. Chief rabbinate is one of the chief rabbi of Israel, is one of the most bizarre positions in the Jewish world. Because do you know how the chief rabbi becomes the chief rabbi? He's elected by the Knesset, by the Israeli parliament. The chief rabbinate of the state of Israel is an agency of the state. And so he's elected by the state of Israel. Now the majority of the Knesset of Israel, of the parliament of Israel, is not religious, by their own definition, whatever that word means. So you have parties like Shinui, whose platform is anti-religious, that's at least how they define it, electing the chief rabbi of Israel. And I remember always thinking, that's so strange. Who created this brilliant system? I mean, you can only imagine the politicking that goes around to get a guy who supports pork farms in Israel to decide who's going to be the chief rabbi of Israel. It seems a little strange. And I always thought, you know, God must have a great sense of humor. Until I read this Rambam. Because by virtue of the fact that the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, actually elects the chief rabbinate, that chief rabbinate, according to the Rambam today, has a din of malchut, of royalty. Now that may not apply to the Knesset, because the Knesset doesn't follow traditional Torah laws, but it certainly applies to the chief rabbinate. Which means that if the chief rabbinate agrees or accepts the laws of the government, which in this case it does, but that's another discussion, then that means that we're not talking about a government of Israel giving land up, we're talking about a king giving land up, which is a whole different discussion. So there are so many different cases and so many different discussions about whether you can give away land, but I'll give you two because in doing a little research and looking at the web, I find that these are the two that are brought up most often. One of them, to be honest, I don't understand. I don't understand, and I finally found an article that agrees with me, Rav Aviner. I don't understand how anybody could consider this to be a legitimate question on the issue, but there are some brilliant scholars who bring it up, so it's worth, and that's the halacha of Baba Machteret. Baba Machteret is a very difficult concept. It basically means that if you're in your home at night, and a thief breaks into your home at night, okay, you're downstairs in your basement, you hear a noise, you go downstairs, and you know, you're like with Ma and Pa Kettle, you got a shotgun. And you see an image in your basement, and you realize he's a burglar. Are you allowed to shoot? If you shoot him and you kill him, you know you're going to be safe. If you don't shoot him and you don't kill him, you don't know. Maybe he's just a teenager looking for bread. Maybe he's somebody who just wants to steal money, but he would never hurt a fly. Or maybe he's got a gun and maybe he'll kill you. Do you have an obligation? Clearly, if the light goes on and he's got a gun and he's pointing at you, you can shoot. That's a principle in Judaism. Habala hargecha ashkem largo. If somebody is about to kill you, you can kill him first. But what if you don't know? So the Torah has a specific verse that says, Hababa machteret, that if a person comes in the night secretly, and you don't know if your life is in danger, and you're afraid it might be, and this is very complicated law, and no one should infer from this specifics for today, and you certainly should not walk away from this discussion thinking that you now know this halacha. It's very complicated. But just as an idea, you are actually allowed to shoot to kill, because the assumption is that a person who comes in the night and is willing to steal in your home, if discovered, will be willing to kill as well. And you can debate this discussion. It's an interesting topic. So some are saying, well, this is like a Baba Machteret. This is, you know, if the Arabs really want peace, that's one thing. But what if they don't want peace? What if what they're doing is understanding that the smartest way to get as much as they can is negotiations? By the way, that was very clearly Arafat's line. In every speech he ever gave to an Arab population, very clearly. It's, by the way, a very valuable thing to listen to what Arab leaders say to the Arabs, not to listen to what they say to the UN. If, in fact, that's still true, and the Arabs are still educating their children to hate, and they still believe that eventually they're going to destroy the state of Israel, and if this negotiation stance is just an attempt to get as much as they can, and once they see they can't negotiate anymore, then they'll go back to their previous stance, then that's a Baba Machteret. They're sneaking into the middle of the night. They're trying to trick us. Very dangerous. The only problem with this discussion, putting aside whether it applies at all to a Baba Machteret, is that it has nothing to do with this issue. Because if in fact that's the case, that this is a Baba Machteret, then that speaks about whether we are allowed to wage war against Arabs. But it has nothing to do with whether a soldier can then remove Jews from settlements. Or, as it's sometimes being used, God forbid, for Jews to be able to do violence to soldiers that are trying to remove them. Is that clear? The second issue, which is a fascinating issue, which I'm just going to raise so you're aware of the question, is the question of Derech HaMelech. Derech HaMelech is a particular issue which you have in America. It's called the right of eminent domain. Okay? If I'm the government, and you live in Englewood, in the biggest house in Englewood, and I need to build a highway through your house, I don't have to ask you if you're willing to let me build a highway. I can show up on your door and say, listen, we valued your house. It's worth $1 million. Here's $1 million. You have 3 months to leave. We're building a highway. And there's nothing you can do about it. And this is a law that's accepted in every civilized country in the world. Countries that aren't civilized do it anyway, but they don't need a law, right? And it makes a lot of sense, because if you couldn't move people out of their homes, you'd have cockamamie highways, right? Et cetera, et cetera. And this is very complicated legally, when it applies, when it doesn't apply. So, perhaps this is the right of eminent domain. We're trying to affect a peace process. There are 8,000 people living in a particular area. We need to move them out. The question, which I'm not getting into for the moment, is whether this is like a highway or a completely different scenario. Okay. The fourth is where we get to the crux of the issue. And this is the question of Siruf Pkuda. So now let's assume for the moment that the government is going to give away, give back, give this area of the Gaza Strip. And let's assume that in order to do so, 8,000 Jews have to be made to leave their homes. And let's assume that we are now ordered as an army unit to go in there and to move those Jews. So there are two possibilities. One possibility is, halachically, religiously, the government has no right to do this. And the other possibility is that halachically, they do have the right to do this. Within those two possibilities come two possibilities for the question of refusing orders. If this is a halachically incorrect decision, but I'm given an order to do it, am I allowed to refuse the order? Is every decision that the government makes that might be non-halachic, do I have then the right or maybe even the obligation to refuse the order? That's the first question. And the second question is, if in fact this is not halachically impermissible, in other words, if the government has a ground to stand on and technically, legally, halachically, Jewishly, traditionally, they can give away a portion of the land of Israel, but nonetheless, I am ethically challenged by this, and I'm bothered by it, and I can't bear the thought of pulling screaming Jewish children from their homes, am I allowed to refuse the order? Clearly, in that case, I'm not obligated, but am I allowed to? Civil disobedience. Am I allowed to do that? Am I allowed to do it as a soldier in the army? And by the way, not just legally, because legally it's very clear that I'm not allowed to, in Israel, in Israeli law, military law, but ethically, Jewishly. Is there a halachic problem with refusing an order if that order is halachically acceptable? In other words, is there a Jewish halachic legal standing to the Israeli army? Now, this is a very complicated question, and the reason it's such a complicated question is because the Israeli army is an army that was built on the principle that you can never say, I was just following orders. I remember we were in officer's course. There was a case. I'm willing to venture that every Israeli officer who's ever done officer's course has studied this case. Very difficult question. There was an Arab village in the 1950s, and there's an order that was given. I actually came from a battalion commander. A lot of trouble, Molotov cocktails, rock throwing, and everything else. And so the battalion commander gave an order that that there should be a curfew. And that any Arabs caught out after the curfew, you should open on them what's called Noal Atzirat Chashud. Noal Atzirat Chashud means the particular procedures for stopping a suspect. In the Israeli army at the time, the standing orders were that you would yell, you know, first, stop or waqif. If that didn't work, you could shoot in the air. If that didn't work, you could shoot at his feet. And if that didn't work, you could shoot in order to kill. So that's a very severe order. And in fact, one day an Israeli patrol in this village was doing a patrol, and they saw two guys in the distance, and they started yelling at them to stop because they weren't allowed to be out, and they were violating curfew. And this is a very difficult Arab village with a lot of problems, a lot of violence in the previous month. And they did exactly that. These two guys started to run, so they did Noal Atzirat Chashud, shot in the air, shot at the ground, and eventually they shot at them, and one of them was killed. Turned out that this was a father and his son who were working in his metal workshop, whatever they were doing. They lost track of time. They came out, it was already dark. They were walking home, way past curfew without having realized it. The Israeli army saw them. They were terrified, Israeli soldiers. And so they took off. And the son, who was 13 years old, was killed. This case made all the papers. By the way, it's irrelevant to me for the moment whether that's exactly as it happened or whether that's what the Arabs said. It doesn't matter. The case is the case. What was amazing about this was the battalion commander was suspended from his post and demoted and given actually jail term al-tnai, suspended sentence, right. Company commander was removed from his position and given a similar sentence. The lieutenant who was on the scene was given a year in jail, as were his soldiers. Now, his soldiers received a direct order in the field under pressure from their lieutenant. You're a soldier and your officer gives you an order. That's an order. You don't play around with orders. So why were they put in jail? The understanding was, if you're an Israeli soldier, you can never say I was following orders. If you're not sure that that order is legal, it's your responsibility to uphold that order. That's a very challenging and a very heavy weight and responsibility that sits on every soldier. I remember once on a Friday afternoon, I had a sadistic sergeant. I'm sure that he had it in for me, but that's a whole other discussion. He came from a kibbutz, and it was a religious kibbutz, and he had kind of dumped his affiliation along the way, and I think, you know, some of the things that I did kind of touched a nerve with him. Anyway, one Friday afternoon, he just wouldn't let me go. And it was getting closer and closer to Shabbat, and I finally poked my head out of the tank. We were doing the regular service in the tanks, and I realized all the other guys were gone. And he kept giving me thing to do after thing to do. There's nothing I could do. I was in sergeant's course. If your commander in sergeant's course tells you that he wants you now to clean the battery, you clean the battery. So we get to an hour before Shabbat, 45 minutes before Shabbat. I realize already I'm not going to get to use the phone. 30 minutes before Shabbat, now I'm starting to realize, am I even going to get a shower? And I'm covered in grease and oil and filth. 10 minutes before Shabbat, I think I'm finally done. I jump down off the tank, and he yells out one more command. Bini bini efod alech. V'dokta bulsai. Go check the driver's night vision. Now to check the driver's night vision, you got to get back up. You got to turn on the 24-volt, the thing. You got to rotate the turret again. You have to go into the gunner section to rotate the turret. So you can get back into the driver's compartment, pull out this thing, check the battery, close the turret, make sure it works. Put it. There's no way that I'm going to do this before Shabbat. So I said, Lo yachol mfaked Shabbat. I can't. It's Shabbat. Shabbat's in 10 minutes. At which point he sticks his head out from the tank with a big smile on his face, looks at me and goes, Tam Saref Kuda? Are you refusing an order? as though he'd been waiting for this all day. That's a very serious thing. I'm not even talking about the fact that you're in sergeant's course, and, you know, if it goes on your record that you refused an order, you're not getting anywhere, you know, in that course. So now you have a minute to think about it. To refuse an order. You know, on the other hand, I got other orders from my commander-in-chief, right? Shabbat. So I look at him and I said, I'm forgetting lecho Shabbat. It's Shabbat. And as I'm saying this, I realize what a ridiculous conversation this has. This guy grew up with Shabbat. He lived on a religious kibbutz. He knows it's Shabbat. And I can see that he's just, And I'm wondering, how did I get into this? What did I do? Was it my American accent? What did I do? So finally I look at him and I say, Ken, I'm sarif kuda. I'm refusing an order. So he looks up, he goes, Atam sarif kuda? You're refusing an order with this grin. At which point I look at him and I said, Lovak shanim sarif kuda. Not only am I refusing an order, but I look forward to the court-martial and I'll explain to the company commander and the battalion commander that it's 8 minutes before Shabbat and you gave me an order that could not possibly be a legal order. And off I walked. With, I cannot begin to tell you, such a depressing feeling in my heart, because I knew that I was going to get thrown out of the course on Sunday morning. I never heard from him about this incident again. Never. He didn't mention it. I wasn't stupid enough to bring it up. Never. I was waiting for the call. I was waiting for the whole thing. Never. But that's a very serious thing, to refuse an order. In fact, when you're a commander, when you're an officer, so the last thing that you want to do is to get to that stage. I remember when I got my first command, so I had a bunch of really tough guys, and they were called Meinikim. They had been drafted into the Israeli army in May. The way the Israeli draft system works is that the first draft of the year is in August, which is right after guys finish high school. Then you have a November draft, a February draft, and a May draft. The guys who get drafted in May, they're the guys who get permission not to go right to the army, to wait almost a year, because they have difficult family situations, they need to work for a year to help support their families, all sorts of stuff like that. So the Meinikim, they call them Mau Mauim, they're a tough bunch. This guy was a Mau Mau. Not only was he a Mau Mau, but he was a Mau Mau with what's called Zman Dafuk. That means that he had, I only found this out the next day, he had been given 3 months jail term. And the 3 month jail term that he had, right, comes al cheshbon. It doesn't count towards your army service. If you have 3 years of army service, you don't do part of it in jail. So you do your 3 months in jail, and then you have to go back and finish up your army service. So he had like a month till he was supposed to get out of the army, and really he was supposed to be out 2 months earlier. And what was the offense for which he had gotten 3 months in jail? Want to take a guess? Punching an officer in the face. So I walk in, and he's, you know, we're down on the tanks and cleaning the tanks, and he's not there. And so his tank is missing a crew member. And the guys are complaining. So I go back up there, and I see Chaim Bello, and he's lying in bed. Right? So I'm the new officer. Right? And I go in, and I go, Chaim, kum. And I'm thinking to myself how ridiculous this is. You know, I should have been in the British Army. In the British Army, you snap your finger, and an adjutant comes. You know, you're a god. You're babysitting. You're waking up, trying to get him up. I'm waking him up. I'm telling him, now I've got a problem, because all the guys, they obviously, I figured this out by now, know that there's no way I'm getting Chaim Bero out of bed. But if I show up without having gotten Chaim Bero out of bed, because I was dumb enough to be down there and say, Mazel Bero Bamita, Mazel Mel, what do you mean Bero's in bed? I'll be right back, which means that I have to now show that I can get him out of bed. So I'm trying to get him out of bed, and he's awake, and I say, you've got 5 minutes, and I come back 5 minutes later, and he's still lying in bed, only it's worse, now he's reading a paper. He's going to like make a statement. So I look at him and say, Kuma lemaita, get out of bed. So he looks at me and he's reading his paper. And I look at him and say, Atam sarif kuda? Are you refusing a direct order? As soon as I say it, I'm like, no, don't, no, come. He looks at me and goes, Hayta po yom echad, higata kvar lezirup kuda? You've been here 1 day, you're already on refusal of orders? That's like a line that you don't get to. When you get to that line, you can't jump back. In the end, we made him Mashak Cafe. We made him the official guy responsible for coffee for all the guys, and that's how I got him down there. But in any case, it's a very serious thing to refuse an order. So what's the issue of order refusal? When do you do it, and when do you not do it? So I'll tell you an interesting thing. First of all, who's the first instance? What's the first instance of a refusal of order in Jewish history, world history? Come on. Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve, Adam refuses the first order that's ever given, right? God says, don't eat from the tree of knowledge, right? Don't eat from the tree of knowledge. And, you know, human beings, we're very good. We just want to know where it is, right? And we eat from the tree of knowledge. And if you look at the theological implications of that first order refusal, so God knows that Adam is going to refuse the order, right? God puts him in the Garden of Eden, tells him there's a tree, tells him he can't eat from the tree, knows that he's going to eat from the tree, and kicks him out of the Garden of Eden, right? You with me so far? Which means that God put us into the Garden of Eden in order to kick us out, right? And it's built into our makeup to refuse orders. Very challenging. When do you refuse order? When do you not refuse an order? It's interesting, by the way, that the dawn of the Jewish people has one of the most fascinating stories in the entire Torah, which is probably one of the best examples of a moment of glory when the refusal of an order makes all the difference. And that's the story of Shifra and Pua. Shifra and Pua were two Egyptian midwives. It's very clear. And, you know, I don't want to oversee my limits, so we're not going to get into the text. But it's very clear if you look in the Torah, right? It says, Ki Yarei Hashem Hema, they were fearful of God. Most of the commentaries say if they were Jewish, it wouldn't have to say they were fearful of God. They may not even have been Jewish. Pshat is they were probably Egyptian women. They were Egyptian women who were given a direct order to throw every Jewish child, Jewish baby, boy, into the Nile. And they refuse. And they're the midwives. And one opinion is they're responsible for all the midwives. And they save thousands of Jewish babies. I mean, these are the first righteous among the Gentiles. This is the Raoul Wallenberg of 3,000 years ago. They're given a direct order. They refuse the order. And they're eternalized in memory forever. But that's an order that itself was illegal. So they refused the order. Does that mean that if you think an order is unethical, you can always refuse that order? Just be willing to pay the price. Difficult question. Avraham. Avraham refuses to accept orders that he's given. Because God says, I'm going to destroy Sodom. Now, Avraham isn't really given an order, he's given a reality. So Avraham struggles with God. But in the end, Avraham accepts that if this is God, then that's what's going to be. What's the better example of Avram being given the ultimate order that may or may not be ethical? Right? The Akedah, the binding of Isaac. Now, I want you to know that this allows us to take a look at the most difficult question. Avram is given an order by God, which seems to be completely unethical, but he's convinced that it comes from God. So Avram does it. Because he believes it's the right thing to do, even though it may be perceived to be unethical. However, there is one interesting challenge with the story of Avraham. And that is, does Avraham know what the order is? If you look at the pasuk, if you look at the verses, God comes to Avraham and says, Ha'alehu sham le'olah, offer him up, right? And Rashi there says, Lo ne'mar ha'alehu, ela ne'mar shachteu. Lo ne'mar shachteu, it doesn't say slaughter him, it says offer him. And many of the authorities, but most notably the Ishbitzer, suggest, you know, Avram doesn't necessarily know exactly what God wants of him. In fact, Avram has to walk around for 3 days and struggle. Did I really hear that voice? Is that what God wants? Does God want me to slaughter him? In fact, one way to interpret the story of the Akedah, which is very challenging, is that the whole purpose of the Akedah was both to demonstrate that Avram was willing to do anything if he believed that that's what God wanted of him, and then to demonstrate to the world that that wasn't what God wanted of him. Because in the end, the challenge wasn't to kill for God, to die for God. The challenge was how to live for God. And so Avram is told not to kill Isaac. I'll give you a better example. Take the story of Yaakov. Yaakov is put in an impossible situation. Impossible situation. He's told by his mother to do something that he clearly believes to be unethical. He's struggling with a lie. Now, that's a dangerous statement, because when you get deep into it, it's not at all clear that what he was doing was unethical. The Torah almost paints it that way to give you the dilemma. But Yaakov essentially is given an order, and he follows the order. So when do you follow the order, and when do you not follow the order? And by the way, I'll tell you an interesting aside. You know, Yaakov, in the portion of Vayeshev, Yaakov finally gets back from this entire journey of being forced to leave his own house because he stole the birthright from Esav, and Esav wants to kill him, and he goes down to the house of Lavan, and he goes through everything he goes through, and finally comes back to the land of Israel, and he survives his encounter with Esav, and it says, Vayeshev Yaakov. So Rashi there quotes, Rashi is the super commentary in the Bible, quotes the Medrash, Bikesh Yaakov Lashevet B'Shalva. All Yaakov wanted to do was to dwell in peace. He just finally wanted some peace. And God says, you're not meant to be in peace in this world. That's not your job. I didn't put you in this world to relax. So miyad yarad alav v'gzor shel Yosef. Immediately, the storm of the whole story of Joseph falls on Yaakov. So one of the questions is, what's so terrible about wanting to sit in peace? But I want you to know, this is our challenge today. Because all we want to do is sit in peace. We just want to dwell in our yeshuvim, in our settlements. And it's almost as though Hashem is telling us, well, you know, that's not why I put you there for. Very difficult. And I want you to know what really challenges me about this is it's easy if you know. I almost envy people who know. Some people know exactly what, you know, this is right and that's wrong. It's all black and it's all white. What if you don't know? You know, you look at the political reality. And by the way, the what if you don't know is not only a personal decision. It's the challenge of looking at someone else's perspective and realize that they don't know. Abu Mazen is a great example. If you ask me strategically, politically, do I trust a person who helped to found the PLO? Do I trust a person whose doctoral degree was on Holocaust denial? I wouldn't invite him to my son's bar mitzvah. But can you know? Can you really know? How far do you go to take risks for peace, and when do you stop? Very dangerous and very difficult question. So, I want to tell you two things. Because there is one last piece. We spoke about the political reality. We spoke about the question of whether the land is part of Israel. We spoke about whether you have a right to give it away if you're a melech. We spoke about whether you can be misarif pkuda before I get to my own opinion. Technically speaking, if a melech gives you an order, then the order is an order. However, if the melech gives you an order which violates halacha, then you're not obligated to listen to that order. If I'm ordered by the army to eat unkosher food, or, as happened in a certain instance, to give unkosher food, let's say, to immigrants, then not only am I not required to do it, I may well be obligated to refuse to do it. But what if the order is not against halacha? So at this point, I would have thought that this is a legitimate question. If you believe that giving away land of Israel or giving away the Gaza Strip is halachically incorrect, then you can and probably should refuse the order. But if you believe that in fact giving away the land of Israel is permissible under certain circumstances, especially if you believe it's going to lead to peace, or if you believe it could lead to peace, whether you're right or wrong is for the moment irrelevant, so then technically you're not violating halacha, and then our soldier doesn't have the right to refuse an order. And if that was the case, if we stopped here, then you would say that whoever says don't refuse an order has a legitimate stand, and whoever says do refuse an order has a legitimate stand, and you can't argue with people who say refuse orders because maybe they're right. But there is one more factor. And this, I think, is the most difficult factor of all. And that's the question of pikuach nefesh. The question of the endangering of life. Now, if we had to pick a piece of this evening, and we're almost done, if we had to pick a piece of this evening that I don't want anybody to walk away with the impression that they've covered a topic, it would be this. There's a very interesting halacha in Siman Shin Yud Chet, the 318th rule, halacha, in the Code of Jewish Law. You know, traditionally speaking, very few things are as powerful and as significant as Shabbat. Chad Ha'am was quoted as saying, more than the Jewish people have kept Shabbat, Shabbat has kept the Jewish people. And for a person at least steeped in tradition, as many of the people living in Gush Katif are, the concept of violating Shabbat is anathema. However, there is one exception, and that is pikuach nefesh. If someone's life is in danger, then you can violate Shabbat. In fact, there's a whole discussion, it may well be, although this is debatable, that it's not that you are allowed to violate Shabbat because someone's life is in danger, but saving a life on Shabbat is an expression of Shabbat. You're obligated. It's part of your Shabbat. You're celebrating Shabbat by making Kiddush, and you're celebrating Shabbat by driving to the hospital with a pregnant woman. Right? The question is, what is pikuach nefesh? Now, let's say somebody's not feeling well. And I'm a rabbi. And let's say Conrad here is a doctor. And Conrad says, listen, his life is in danger. So then you violate Shabbat. And let's say Conrad, the doctor, says, you know, I don't think his life is in danger. But I'm the rabbi. And I say, listen, I've seen enough people. I don't care. I don't know from your medical experience. I'm not taking a risk. I think his life might be in danger. You have a guy with heart pain. You have a cardiologist, the head of the Department of Cardiology from Boston Mass General. And he says, you don't have to worry. And I see a guy with a heart pain. I said, you know, I don't care. You say it's heartburn. I don't care. I think his life's in danger. I'm driving to the hospital. Am I allowed to drive him to the hospital?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Amazing halacha. If the rabbi says it's pikuach nefesh, the life is in danger, and the doctor says no, you listen to the rabbi. If the doctor says it's pikuach nefesh, and the rabbi says halachically no, you listen to the doctor. Here's the most amazing part. Let's say, Nebuch, what's your name?
Eli.
Pardon?
Eli.
Let's say Eli Chas v'Shalom has a headache. And he doesn't know what to do. So he comes to me, I said, listen, it's a headache, don't worry about it. But he's not satisfied. So he talks to, I don't know, now Conrad's a neurologist. It's amazing, all right? So he talks to Conrad, the neurologist, and he says, listen, you think this is dangerous? No, I don't know about it. And he says, you know what? I don't care what you say, and I don't care what you say. I think I have a brain tumor in my life. My life is in danger. Are you allowed to get in the car and drive in the hospital?
Yes.
Yes. If anybody thinks that there might be an endangerment of life, this is a complicated halacha, by the way, so don't think you know the halacha, but it's a case. You take whichever opinion says pikuach nefesh. That's an amazing halacha. In fact, pikuach nefesh, a danger of life, is one of the only instances where not only are you lenient in the case of a doubt, but you're even lenient in the case of a double doubt. In other words, let's say there's a doubt that it could be life endangering. Like, you think you have, you think you have pressure on the ear, and you're not sure if pressure on the ear is life endangering. And then, even if it was pressure on the ear, you're not sure you have pressure on the ear. So it's like a double doubt. When it comes to pikuach nefesh, a life is in danger, double, triple, doesn't matter, you don't take a risk. So that brings us back to our case. Is there pikuach nefesh here? Such a complicated question. If we give it away, and a war results, that's pikuach nefesh. If we don't give it away, and Israeli soldiers' lives are endangered, and Jews who are living there are endangered, that's pikuach nefesh. The halacha in such a case of pikuach nefesh is, if you have a doctor and you have a rabbi, and either one of them says there's pikuach nefesh, that's where you go. Now, who's the doctor and who's the rabbi? This is very interesting. So here we get to what I think. And I want you to know, this is a very difficult question. And in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to tell you why everything I've told you till now is a complete waste of time. And I want you to know that I knew that if we have this topic, we have to have this discussion, because I think it's also important to know the facts. But in a minute, I'm going to tell you why this has nothing to do with the issue. My Rebbe, and also the Rebbe of my Rebbes, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who's the Rosh Hashiva of Gush, gave a very difficult discussion a number of years ago, in which he talked about giving portions of the land of Israel away. At the time, he was clearly not the majority opinion, but has since become the majority opinion. And my opinion, from what I've seen, is that most of the posts can agree that, we'll get to that in a second. But he believes that technically, halachically, you can give away a portion of the land of Israel if it's pikuach nefesh. In other words, the issue of giving away land for peace is not an issue of whether technically you're allowed to give land. That's what he believes. It's a question of whether it's really for peace. Now the problem is, how do you know if it's really for peace? Who do you ask? So you have a doctor and you have a rabbi. So the rabbi, a guy like me, lives in Efrat. A guy like Rav Aviner, a guy who lives in Beit El, a guy who lives in Gush. And then you have the doctor. The doctor in this case is the military general. Or maybe the politician. You know, there's always this sort of mystique. If he's the prime minister, there must be things he knows that I don't know. I always wonder whether that's really true, or whether it's just a healthy mystique because you get to do what you want because you don't know anything, and I do. Because I sat with Bush for an hour. So how do you know? But when it comes to pikuach nefesh, that's a very dangerous question. And what's fascinating about the element of pikuach nefesh in this instance is because pikuach nefesh intrudes on the day, then you get another issue, which is what's pikuach nefesh of Meit Habam Lefanecha? When do you have life endangerment that stands before you, and when do you have life endangerment on the horizon? Life endangerment that stands before you means somebody's crossing the street, and the car is coming, and his life is in danger. Life endangerment that's in the distance means that we have to create an organ bank, because down the road somebody may need an organ. So are we allowed to transgress Shabbat to create an organ bank? Clearly, in halacha, when you have these two that come into conflict with each other, the meit balach lefanecha is what comes first. The instance of a life that's standing before you comes first. So that's a very difficult question. Because technically speaking, there's no doubt that in the short term, it's a legitimate opinion at least, that if you pull the Jews out of the Gaza Strip, they won't be katyushot on them tomorrow morning. However, the long-term effect may be that there'll be katyushot on Ashkelon. And so therefore, the question of pikuach nefesh allows for the illusion, or for the dilemma, or for the doubt. In other words, my claim is that no one can know. You can't know. Anybody who says they know, can't know. So now, having said all this, I'll tell you my opinion. And I'll tell you why this is so dangerous. And I'll tell you what I think we need to do. You know, it's interesting that the name that's been chosen for this is Hitnatkut, a separation. The Hitnatek, you know, if you just had enough, you need to get away. You go off in the desert, you Hitnatek. You cut yourself off. Hitnatkut is to cut yourself off. Words that are used always have meaning. You know, for example, this week there was a big uproar because the name of the mission that the army had given to the Mitzvah, to the mission to remove the Jews from Gush Katif, was they were going to call it Shevet Achim, as in Shevet Achim Gam Yachad, the sitting of brothers. So politicians from across the political spectrum went nuts. This is the name you give. It turned out that this was chosen from a computer program or whatever. This is the name you give for uprooting Jews from their homes? Shevet Achim Gam Yachad? You can't find a more sensitive name? So actually, Bugi Yalon, the chief of staff, agreed that this is an inappropriate name. They decided they're going to change it. So Hitnatkut, what does Hitnatkut mean? Why that name? So before I tell you what I think of that and why I think this is all a waste of time, I'll just tell you the conclusions. First of all, I want you to know that I believe that Siruv Pkuda, the refusal of orders, is a mistake from start to finish. It was a tremendously terrible mistake for the right to make this the issue. This should not be the issue. First of all, I'm not convinced that that many people are going to do this. I don't think that many soldiers are going to refuse these orders, as much as the press likes to make hay of it. But I think that the right is making a terrible mistake in making this the issue, because it gives the left the chance to vilify the right. And it's irrelevant to me whether you in this audience are on the left or on the right. When one group of Jews is vilifying another group of Jews, that's bad for everybody. That's the first problem. The second problem, Siruf Kuda, the refusal of an order, is so dangerous for one very simple reason. You know, the Baal Shem Tov says that whenever you see something, don't assume that it's because you're there to fix it in someone else. Assume it's a message that this is something you need to work on in yourself. If you see somebody speaking slander, there's a message that you're struggling with the mitzvah of slander. If you see somebody desecrating Shabbat, it's because you need to work on your Shabbat. Don't spend so much time yelling Shabbos. Work on your Shabbat. By the way, conversely, if you can go to a retreat and want to retreat for 300 people and know that 290 of them have never celebrated Shabbat in their lives, and yet you don't happen to see any desecration of Shabbat that Shabbat, that's because that happens not to be your issue. Get nervous if you're sitting at the table and everybody's talking slander. That then is your issue. Everybody keeps talking about the fact that this is going to lead to civil war. That all the social and civil strife issues have been swept under the carpet are going to raise up like a storm. What we're really dealing with here is how polarized we are as a society. That Israeli soldiers could come and have to pull other Jews out of their homes. That Jews will essentially be fighting Jews. And I wonder if that isn't because what Hashem is telling us is that this is what our generation needs to work on. We've become too separate. We've become minutak. You know, there's an article, I think it was by Professor Sperber, broke down Israeli society and said that there are three basic groupings. Obviously, this is a generalization. Each of these groupings has many, many subgroupings. Three basic groupings. There are what he calls the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox. I personally think I'm ultra-Orthodox, but for the purpose of discussion, we'll use the stereotypes. Then there are what he calls the Datiim Lumim, the religious Zionists. And then there's what he calls the Chilonim, the secular. Put aside for the moment that I disagree with all those categorizations, for the purpose of discussion. He says one of these groups is focused on Torah. They live in their Beit Midrash. And their world is around Torah. And their island is the Beis Medrash, the house of study. One of these groups is focused on land. And their island is their yeshuvim and their settlements. And one of these groups is focused, so he claims, I'm not so sure I agree, by and large, on themselves. And their island is themselves. Now, putting aside how real and how dangerous that categorization is, the fact that you could have such a discussion points to the problem. And those of us with kippot on our heads, who live in Israel and who've become so focused on settling and conquering the land, have become so focused on the land, we've separated ourselves from the rest of Israeli society. You know, there's a verse that we sing in Kabbalat Shabbat. One day the day will come, Yismechu Iyim Rabim, and the many islands will rejoice. Who are the islands? We've become a people of islands. The concept of a yeshuv, you know, one of the things I love about Efrat, where I live, is that they're religious and secular. They're right and left. People there have voted for secular parties, for right-wing parties, etc. And every now and then I'll get somebody, a friend, you know, who I learned with in yeshiva, and he'll say, how could you live in a place where there are, like, more secular Jews, and doesn't it make you nervous? And I think dafka, it's a very healthy thing for my children to see that society is not unidimensional, that it's broad. And many of the yeshuvim, many of the settlements, whatever that word means, are beautiful places, magnificent places. You spend a Shabbat in a place like Beit El, in a place like Ofra. Magnificent. But they're islands. We've become so separate. You know, it's like you walk into the dining room and you like to sit with the people who are from your social gathering, but then you never become a one. Where is the one place in Israel where you really have a melting pot? The one place in Israel where everyone comes together is the army. The army, it's not accidental. The yichida. The Hebrew word for unit is yichida. There's an achdut, an echadness, a oneness that's created in the army. And if we allow politics to enter the army, if Israeli soldiers start to draw political lines as part of their army service, that will be the biggest, and I'm not talking about the state of Israel. The state of Israel is a vehicle. I'm talking about the people of Israel. This will destroy the people of Israel. I think, by the way, on two levels, just for the purpose of sharing an opinion. First of all, it's a very dangerous thing. I have never stood in a foreign country and publicly disagreed with the Prime Minister of Israel. I've always felt that this is not the place. That what the State of Israel does and the Prime Minister, we have to listen to what he says. But I will tell you that I'm very, very concerned with this plan. It's very frightening. You know, the Netziv, Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin from 100 plus years ago, writes on a verse in Dvarim. It says, Yakecha Hashem b'shigaon. Hashem will send madness with varon and with blindness. There'll come a time when you'll be blind. So the Netziv says, what does that mean? It doesn't mean you won't be able to see. It means that there will be things that you should be able to see, and for some reason you'll be blinded to them. And it'll be so strange, it'll be so impossible to understand how a person couldn't see it, that you'll imagine people are mad. Sane people will seem like they're mad. I wonder if that's this generation. It's been now 11 years since Oslo. It's safe to assume that most people agree that Oslo was a failure. It's been 4 years since the year 2000. We've seen what giving guns to Palestinians does. It does not produce wonderful harmony. We know what they teach their children in their schools. The latest is that Abu Mazen has begun to talk to Hamas, to Hezbollah, telling them that they're wrong. But until he makes them do differently, is this a risk we should take? You know, I like Sharansky's line. Nathan Sharansky was quoted in this week's paper as saying that Eric Sharon missed a golden opportunity. He You should have made these things conditional on democratic reform. Forget halacha, forget democratic reform. Have real elections. There was an Arab politician from Egypt who visited Israel. And he's actually running, he wants to become the next president of Egypt. And he was speaking about the Egyptian dictatorship, etc. Talks about, you know, why Egypt wants to destabilize the region, and etc. Very frightening. So first of all, very dangerous. This plan is very frightening. And you wonder, you know, when Yitzhak Rabin started this whole process, he called it Nisayon, the experiment of Aza and Yericho first. An experiment means you have a control. We're going to take an experiment. Here's the measure. Here's how we know if we succeeded or we failed. So what's the measure of failure? At what point do you say we failed? What would it take if you would have been in 1993 and you would have been talking and you would have said, well, here's the measure of we know we failed. Well, let's say that they take the guns that we've given them and they use them against Israeli soldiers. That would be a measure of failure. Let's say terrorism increases. That would be a measure of failure. Let's say they're teaching war in their schools. That would be a measure of failure. You could not come up with a measurement for failure that we have not long since passed. And by the way, the most frightening thing, and again, it's very easy from the side, maybe there are things we don't know. But the most frightening thing is that if you look at the debacle that was the pullout from Lebanon, I personally was very much in favor of pulling out of Lebanon. I didn't think we needed to be in Lebanon. And I tell you that from a strategic officer's perspective. But I think the way in which we pulled out of Lebanon was horrible. Because we gave a clear message to the Arabs that we're pulling out because of terror. And it's not accidental that a few months after we pulled out of Lebanon, all hell broke loose all over Israel. Because they learned that terrorism pays. And you wonder if that's what we're doing again. So if you ask me, do I think that this is the right time to do this, it's very frightening. Okay. If you're going to do this, the greatest mistake that we're going to make is to use soldiers to do it. This is not the place of the Israeli army. The Israeli army is an entity that was created to protect the people of Israel, to safeguard against the people of Israel. They should be guarding the borders while the police are pulling out Jews if that's what has to happen. It's a terrible, terrible, frightening thing that the Israeli army is going to be used for this. Having said all that, if they do this, and if the Israeli army does this, and putting aside for the moment that every Jew has the right to express his opinion and to demonstrate his opinion, whether he's on the left or whether he's on the right, the idea in this instance of refusing orders in the Israeli army is the quickest vehicle for destroying the state of Israel and our relationship with the land of Israel that I can think of. Very frightening. And if you ask me, as much as I believe, you know, when I refused that order on that Friday afternoon, I knew that I might pay a price for it. And I was prepared to pay the price for it. And every soldier who refuses, and by the way, this is not just a soldier who refuses to evacuate somebody from Gaza, but a soldier who refuses to serve in Lebanon or to serve in Ramallah, and anyone who tells soldiers that they should refuse orders should be willing to pay the price. And I think it should be a severe price. Now we get to the last point, and I want you to know this whole discussion is nothing. Because I want you to know now comes the real point. You see, we're making a terribly dreadful error. This is not the issue. The issue is not whether we should give the land to the Arabs. The issue is not how we create democratic reform. If we're seeing what we're seeing, it's because we're doing something wrong. We're seeing a hitnatkut, a separation, a pulling away, because we have become a separated people. You know, you listen to the newspapers, the radios, and they talk about, you know, wearing red badges. No, you can't do that because. Well, we're going to line the streets. No, you can't do that because. How are we going to stop this? How are we going to keep the land? Should we give the land? Nobody's talking about, well, why is it that such, and it doesn't matter for me, referendum, majority, not majority. Why is it that so many hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Jews in Israel don't believe that there's a value to hanging on to this piece of land? Why is it that Jews have such different opinions? If my opinion makes so much sense, if I find it so beautiful, you know, for 100 years, traditional Judaism spent a tremendous amount of time trying to vilify those Jews that didn't celebrate Shabbat. Finally, about 30, 40 years ago, Jews started to wake up to the fact, if other Jews aren't celebrating Shabbat, maybe it's because we're not painting such a beautiful picture. Because if Shabbat was that beautiful, and you could share it with someone, who wouldn't want to celebrate Shabbat? And if you could come celebrate Shabbat with me, and you don't want to celebrate Shabbat when you're done celebrating Shabbat with me, that's not a problem with you. That's a problem with me. Then my Shabbat is not as beautiful as I think it is. If you're not interested in love, if you think love is for the birds, I can't prove to you that love makes sense. I can share with you what love is. I can hope that you find love like I found love. If you could find love like I found love, if you met someone like I met someone, you couldn't not be in love. And I wouldn't have to sell you on it. So if I love the land of Israel with every fiber of my being, if I walk in the Golan Heights, and all I want to do is take my shoes off to feel the earth beneath my feet, if the land of Israel is not just a piece of real estate, if it's a part of who we are, if it's a part of our history and our heritage, if until we came home to the land of Israel, we were an exiled group of individuals, and only when we came back to the land of Israel did we become a nation with a home, if only as a nation in a home can we be a role model, can we make a difference? And if because of that, every piece of land that we dreamed of for 2,000 years is special, then when and if we give up a piece of that land, which I personally believe halakhically you can do in certain situations, I'm just not convinced this is one of them, but when and if we would give up a piece of that land, then the entire Jewish people should be in tears. And that would be an amazing thing. And if half the Jewish people are not in tears, then my question is not to them. My question is to us. We're missing the boat. I would love to see the right wing in Israel say, we need to create educational programming and experiences to share what we love with the rest of the Jewish community. And let them share with us what they love. And that could be such a different place. And now we get to the last point. So what can you do? Sit here in New York. And it's an interesting topic. So I want to tell you something. I'm not going to embarrass anybody here by asking the question. But you ask yourself. My daughter is almost 15 years old. And she's been to Gush Katif. Because she wanted to see what it was about. When was the last time you were in Gush Katif? When was the last time you visited? When was the last time you visited Israel? Before we struggle with this issue, if nothing else, struggling with this issue should make you want to be not a spectator to Jewish history, but a part of it. Come visit. Explore what it means. Discover why people are struggling with this. And you and us and all of us will become the better for it. I do believe, Bezrat Hashem, that we are dealing with issues that are on such a different level. You know, I got back to Israel. We were in Boca for 3 years on Shlichut. Came back to Israel. Somebody recently asked me, so, you know, now that you've been there a few months and you're back, do you miss it? So, you know, do I miss Boca? I mean, yeah, I miss Sunday mornings. I definitely miss Sunday mornings. I said, you know, your kids have such different issues now. Stress, is it difficult for them? You know, they live in an area, whatever. I said, you know, my kids sit around the Shabbat table and they're talking about reality. They have such different questions. My son is 12 and they have a B'nai Akiva group and they go and they sit and they talk and he came home with all sorts of questions about what I think, about what would I do and would I refuse orders. And that's such a different place to be in. That's your challenge. Your challenge is, how do you make it more a part of who you are? On the first level, I'm not even talking about the fact that eventually we should all be living in Israel. There should be no Jew in America today who doesn't visit Israel at least once a year. We can't even justify it economically anymore. We can't honestly look back knowing that there are $700 and $800 tickets and not really say at the end of the year that we didn't spend $800 that we could have spent better. So if, Bemet, you give every extra penny you have to Jewish orphans and victims of terror, okay. Something to think about. And by the way, Ram Chas V'Shalom is a guilt trip. Don't go to Israel because Biddy made me feel bad. That's not at all the No, that's not at all the intent. I don't want anybody to feel bad. You should feel good. It's an incredible thing. You're a Jewish community that came, I'll be honest with you, if I worked hard and I lived in New York and it was a Thursday night, I'd be out watching the football game. So you're like a high level of the Jewish community in America because you're willing to come out and listen to this topic. That's amazing. Nebuch, right. Soccer. No. Soccer, everybody runs after the ball. They finally get to it, they kick it away. It makes no sense. Anyway, Bezrat Hashem, I look forward to discussing with you how this theoretical question became a non-issue. I look forward to discussing with you in Israel, in Yerushalayim, on the rooftop of Israelite. I thank you so much for coming and for sharing this evening.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.